Thank you for downloading this podcast recorded at the Manchester Metropolitan University Institute for Performance Research Conference in June 2011.
Welcome to this morning's stroke afternoon session. A lot more of a long-winded introduction to everybody. So I shall immediately hand over to our first speaker, Sam Oldfield.
Hello, thank you for coming this morning. Trying to go from a different perspective, I suppose, from just down the coaching route, looking at it from a historical perspective. I'd just like to start with a quote by Lawrence Mitchell, which says, "All historians throughout their careers confront the ways in which history of their particular era and region is written. Methodologies, approaches to the sources, even the kind of sources privileged have changed over time, compelling us to reassess how we think about the past, how and what we read as sources, and where we locate our scholarship in the historiographical and methodological continuum." History is a social science which considers events and facts of the past in the present, and does so through constantly evolving theories and methodologies. Historical research is a contested area, as historical knowledge is continually developing and there is no set structure to the way it should be recorded. Historians examine and contest issues such as how war was fought, what ancient Rome looked like, and who were the true heroes and villains by exposing cracks in the literature. But they themselves are reporting from a particular perspective which further fuels these disputes. The growth of higher education in the 20th century has acted as a catalyst, encouraging the emergence of a diverse range of historical perspectives, approaches, and understandings which deviate from traditional historical narratives, causing a conflict in the historical pursuit for truth. According to Lustig, history should aptly be renamed histories, as it is a collection of different interpretations on the same topic. And Fulbright concurs, revealing history is about imposition of interpretations, the construction of meanings, endowing and investigating selected remnants of the past with meaning in the present, not reconstructing it as it actually was. The conclusion drawn is that history will never really be known, but can be reconstructed in a variety of ways through a range of sources, as Carr observes. History consists of facts. The facts are available to the historian in documents, inscriptions, and so on, like fish on a fishmonger's slap. The historian collects them, takes them home, and cooks and serves them in whatever style appeals to them. Carr describes the well-established empiricist approach, where evidence is observable by the senses. Surviving documents of the past are interrogated, pieced together systematically, and presented to form a well-rounded explanation which can be tested. Similar to the Victorian approach, whereby history is a cumulative process which is revised and enriched over generations. Although this empirical perspective is significant to the present research, the postmodernist viewpoint also needs to be understood, since it is here that the majority of historical conflict derives. The interpretation of facts is central to postmodernist debate, many whom deny the existence of truth and explain reality as an interpretation of what the world means to each individual. The perspective is sceptical of science and epistemological justification, suggesting that every historian's experience of society will come before the evidence, and as a result, history is fictional and therefore cannot be trusted. Due to vague theoretical views, postmodern philosophy has been challenged by empirical critics, such as Agger, who argues that postmodernists need to write more clearly and in ways that show the empirical relevance of their work more directly in order to be acknowledged methodologically. The traditional empiricists would argue that in relation to narrative, history is based on physical evidence, which has been collective and objectively discussed, whereby the modern empiricist, who is more sensitive to the postmodern stance, would suggest, while there is a need to engage and identify with the information, imagination and inventiveness are crucial to creating a solid narrative. Although postmodernists believe that this identification with the evidence encourages a modified and idealistic historical undercurrent, turning fact into fiction, the empirical and pragmatic approach is defended by Evans and Stone, who insist that theoretical models can be used to recreate a real past and guide narratives towards the truth, even though truth itself is subjective. True history is a romanticised concept because even those with the facts have to create a narrative surrounding the topic, which, by nature, encourages an element of interpretation. The narrative truth is the compromise, taking these ideals and reproducing an honest reenactment through story. And it is here that the balance between empiricism and postmodernity can be achieved by utilising historical facts to construct an accurate representation of the past while creating a story which is open to a degree of interpretation. Prosopography, or collective biography, describes external features of a population group that the researcher has determined has something in common. Following the creation of, and or interrogation of, individual biographies through archival research and the analysis of that data to contextualise historical processes in a specific environment. For example, that of a Manchester publican during the mid-19th century with strong involvement in local pedestrianism. This methodology tends towards the empirical rather than the postmodern, although the emphasis has moved away from simply reporting observations to applying them to a real-world environment. According to Stone, prosopography is the investigation of the common background characteristics of a group of actors in history by means of a collective study of their lives. The method employed is to establish a universe to be studied and then ask a set of uniformed questions about birth and death, marriage and family, social origins and inherited economic position, place of residence, education, amount of source of wealth, occupation, religion, experience of office, and so on. The term prosopography has been used since the 1920s, although the method itself originated in the early 19th century. Traditionally, prosopographical studies have been focused on the medieval, Roman, and Byzantine communities due to the plethora of information surrounding these eras and the ability to collect this work and develop it into large-scale databases. More recently, the changing nature of historical thinking has enabled a new prosopography to emerge, which still discusses persons according to name, establishing the social context of groups, such as ethnic and regional origin, family connections and careers, but is equally concerned with the networks of which each individual forms a part. This new prosopography benefits from the technological revolution and the computer age, using new techniques and advancements such as online archives and validating their importance and significance in the historical world. Access to more modern information has seen prosopography begin to interrogate 19th century inhabitants, but this is in its early stages and there is a need for more complex prosopographical studies in many historical periods and subject-specific areas such as sport. While prosopography is still mostly used by classical historians, collective biography has been adopted by historians of later years. Both share the same meaning, but the association with biography introduces this method to a new concern. Biography, by definition, is a collection of live documents which describe turning point moments in individuals' lives. But collective or group biography is not the biography of groups, but rather the study of the biographical details about individuals in aggregate, analysing the connections between individuals, not the specifics which make their lives unique. Both are related, but as Magdaleno notes, the primary concern of one is the secondary concern of the other. Biography has long been a respected source for historical research, but group biography has been judged a lesser instrument due to its ambiguous nature and lack of socio-historic use, causing those who use it to have to justify its power as an analytical tool. Tilley suggests that collective biography is open to various interpretations, and as a methodology, it exposes connections which lead to false correlations, although Cantor insists that biography is also open to falsifications, and that by cross-correlating data, a historical truth can be found through prosopographical analysis. Historians face many issues surrounding the validity of sources, and this methodology attempts to overcome this by subjecting a population to a standardised set of questions in order to expose shared qualities. Mommsen's seminal work on the history of Rome moved beyond traditional narrative as a reliable source and used epigraphy, numismatics and comparative linguistics to enable the reconstruction of families and social groups in the ancient world, and guiding historians towards a broader spectrum of primary materials in order to increase the dependability of their research. Keats Rohan believes the prosopographer should allow their sources to be made public, reducing the chance of falsification and ensuring an empirical structure. There is a need for researchers to be careful of generalising too broadly and to ensure that the sample is representative. The individuals selected should be common to the populace as the unique are of no importance, and the average represents the collective, enabling common characteristics and distinctive traits of the group to be established in relation to the historical situ. And this is a defining feature of mass prosopography. This type of prosopography, which examines social ties and connections between people, helps to explain ideological or cultural change by examining surviving evidence and documentation relating to persons of lower social status who are common to all historical periods. The decision about how to apply prosopography will be very different in each case, because sources differ from period to period, the questions of interest differ from historian to historian, and the available methods or techniques for data analysis continue to evolve. Although traditional prosopographical work aims to establish large databases, the method is not adverse to a small-scale approach. Previous work in this area has focused on elite individuals, but as new forms of collective biography have identified, the anonymous population can also be worthy of discussion, and it is these individuals who do not require extensive profiles. Magdaleno maintains prosopography is most useful in the study of societies where the number of recorded individuals is relatively modest and where the records do not lend themselves to the construction of major biographies. In arguing that a small selection of biographies can be used to understand individuals on a collective scale, Cunningham shows that the potential for small-scale prosopography in the development of histories and biographies shows the potential for small-scale prosopography in the development of existing histories and biographies. Currently, I'm undertaking work in the field, constructing biographies of 19th century Manchester sporting publicans using 19th century national and local newspapers and periodical archives, photographs, trade directories, census material, contemporary maps, and local and family histories, and then interrogating these collectively, highlighting the continuities and changes in the roles adopted by these individuals with respect to pedestrianism in particular. Profession as publican and geographical location of Manchester have already been determined as initial defining features of the group. Nevertheless, there are further avenues to explore, including social structures, origins and economic classes of the individuals, with developments on previous research to be expected. It is important to note that although this study aims to establish an accurate account of the 19th century publican and their involvement with sport, based on archival sources and further academic evidence, that this is simply not the only interpretation of the information. No two people would write the same biography, even with the same sources in front of them. Each historian is creating an interpretation of the historical period, which may gloss over an area which they have little knowledge, but is still an accurate representation supported with evidence. Several layers of truth will emerge over time through the examination of a particular path, which then presents a new piece of the puzzle, helping to create a true portrait of the individual. The aim of this research is to construct biographies of 19th century Manchester publicans with strong involvement in local pedestrianism, to interrogate these, highlighting comparisons and differences, and to draw conclusions relating to commonalities. Through this table, several defining features of the Manchester entrepreneur can be drawn. If we look at location to start, although many publicans were born and lived locally, just as many migrated from other parts of England. The profession of professional pedestrian encouraged athletes to regularly move and settle in new locations. Usually, the settling down would be due to their marriage and subsequent upbringing of their children. If you take example George Martin, he was originally from London, relocated to Manchester in the 1850s when he married, and Thomas Hayes from Wolverhampton also married a local woman before taking licence at the Shears Inn. It is also important to note that the majority of these individuals were not only publicans, but they had skilled trades which they still practised. This trade was passed from father to son and then passed to their children too. Holden's father, James Holden at the White Lion, his father and brothers were all in the calico business as printers, engravers and sellers, and his brother also apprenticed his son, James Holden Jr., in the business. Now, if we turn our attention to this idea of being a professional athlete and trainer, the majority of these individuals were professional athletes prior to and during their publican days. All except Piers were successful pedestrian athletes, with Piers instead being a rower. And with Martin, George Martin and William Lang leading the field. Martin was a wonder kid within the sport, eventually retiring to become a trainer of English champion athletes, travelling to America and returning with native runner Lewis Deerfoot Bennett. Lang became the record holder for the mile, completing it in 4 minutes and 17 and a half seconds at Martin's Royal Oak Park in 1865. Research suggests that the move from athlete to trainer is a natural progression, but within this research, it is currently inconclusive. The next 3 points prove extremely important within the role of sporting publican: the dependence on kinship ties within the business, collaboration with others in the sporting world, versatility in the role of publican, and essential personal traits such as honesty and respect have been found through each example. According to Anderson, kinship ties were important in Victorian Lancashire. Family was instrumental to the employment and encouraged trades to be passed down from father to son. But this was not exclusive to the immediate family, as it also included relations such as son-in-laws, as illustrated here by Martin and Piers, who both married daughters of Holden and were given support in their sporting roles. Holden was known as the great stakeholder of Lancashire pedestrianism, and Martin and Piers' association with him validated their place within the athletic community. All these publicans were positively received and were entrusted with further responsibilities, such as holding stakes for upcoming events, not just within pedestrianism, but with other sports too. Referee at different races within different grounds, timekeeper and starter, and this had much to do with their position within the sport, their contacts and public opinion as being honest, respectable and obeying. Each individual did not act alone. They worked with each other to ensure success not only for the sport but for their business too, most notably Martin and Hayes, who both owned running grounds on Oldham Road. Martin's Royal Oak Park at 496 Oldham Road and Hayes Copenhagen Grounds were at 540 Oldham Road. Although in competition with each other, both would ensure fixtures did not clash, and there were reports that spectators flocked from one ground to the other to attend different races and then return to the original destination for evening entertainment. There is a need to examine the subject further to see if this template is exclusive to Manchester and to also uncover additional traits of the sporting publican. Meaning has to be given to Manchester's sporting establishments and their clientele by way of their narrative existence. These people came from somewhere and made up the demographics of the mid-century population, which is in need of further further investigation. In the future, this can then be compared to individuals in other locations such as Sheffield, London and Birmingham. Readers should not generalise these results to the whole population, but use this as a basis on which to build a comprehensive and multifaceted 19th century sporting prosopography. Thank you for your time.
Very, very interesting. I have several questions, but I'll first open the floor. Questions for Sam.
Well, no, there was a really successful ground in London, also called the Copenhagen Grounds, and I think what they, you know, during the period, they thought, well, it's successful down there, we'll take it elsewhere. You know, no real association with, you know, the area.
Were they international competitors?
You see some come over from America, but not European, no. So why they called it Copenhagen Grounds, I really have no idea.
It's, if you look at the Dr. Button, if you look at the period of time, there's a famous general's horse called Copenhagen. There were battles on the continent called the Battle of Copenhagen and so on. And we were getting into a completely new royal dynasty which had those kind of connections with Hanover and whatever. So it made sense to try and appeal to the public.
Well, it's
sorry.
Yes.
Sorry.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you for the talk.
Could
you are any of your sources available for the research of PhD online?
Yeah, a lot of this, yeah. Although I've been to more traditional archives, a lot of the information now is, you know, the newspapers, the plethora of information about the 19th century has all of a sudden, you know, been starting to be digitised. So the British Library have digitised a lot of the sporting papers of the time, you know, and just general newspapers. The Manchester Guardian, you know, now The Guardian, they have a historical online archive, census material through the archive, you know, with the help of the lovely Margaret Roberts there, you know, she's been great in helping me track some of these individuals. But yeah, you know, there is also things which I appreciate are not online, and, you know, there is a case of still having to go through that process of really trying to find information. Recently went down to the British Library and found some pictures that have been put in the Illustrated Sporting News of some of the people that I've been, you know, looking at, you know, prior to the photograph. So yeah, that's something that I couldn't get anywhere else.
Thank you. I don't know anything about prosopography. It already makes me think, you know, 100 years from now, people are going to be able to put prosopography on their sports scientists.
Well, yeah.
It's always done.
But one of your individuals speaks to me, is that right?
Yeah.
Anne
Attenbury, yeah. Originally, it was a husband who started the Borough Grounds, the Borough Inn, which became the Salford Borough Gardens. It was, you know, running arena. We do start to see, you know, women do start to take on the role of publican, especially, you know, in grounds that have been developed. So, you know, areas which have specific enclosed running grounds. The women will take on responsibility of running the establishment to allow the husbands to, you know, get the interest, get people coming in through the gates. And Anne Attenbury, her husband John, originally was at the public house. He died. She then took on that role and continued to do so, but with the help of, she did have her sons who also still lived at home. But she's not the only one. There's, you know, Betty Aspel, who was also at the Royal Oak. So yeah, you do see, especially towards, as we get, you know, the later periods, 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, you do start to see women, you know, taking on that role. Mm-hmm.
The question is going to ask you, you made important points about the selective nature of narratives based on the sources, and the recognition that these are, if you like, selective perspectives. Is there anything you've been able to identify on, because of the nature of the data sources that you have used, that hasn't been? Is there anything sort of, you know, potentially of interest but relatively invisible, for example? Or is there a particular, one thing, for example, might be, it isn't social class because you've got occupations there, mm-hmm. but are there any features of these stories that are missing because of the way the data has been written?
Yeah, I don't think you will ever get a true feeling of what these individuals were like. You know, sitting doing an oral history, you can get a personality across. You know, you can understand, you know, people's perceptions and ideologies. But this type of research, you know, you're looking at a news report of, you know, what was going on, and, you know, their language, you know, which may portray a particular picture of these individuals. So, you know, the conclusion here, I suppose, about being valued by the sporting community in terms of honour, respect, them sort of ideologies, you can only get that through, you know, the reports which say, you know, the respectable James Holden, you know, the urbane Thomas Hayes. But, you know, whether that was actually them and their personality, you can't really say. But I've just recently done a chapter on George Martin, and he had a fantastic life, really, you know, some really interesting information. He ended up in a mental institution, you know, bipolar disorder, because he was, you know, totally consumed with this type of sporting world. And, you know, some of the things, you know, he was taken to court for not paying his athletes, you know, working them 7 days a week, you know, with that sort of thing. But that's only, you know, like I say, it's my perception of him, and, you know, you get these beautiful reports about it, but actually at the end of the day, when I construct it, I've got to try and be subjective, but try and bring out this personality, this eagerness to really want the sport, you know, to work, which could be easily be translated as he was a tyrant, you know.
So is it your construction?
Yeah, I'm constructing the biographies.
Rather than the analysis of the discourse of the way that biographies are constructed by the writers.
Yeah, I'm doing both. These individuals are not, you know, like I said, they're average individuals, really, haven't been discussed before. You know, William Lang may be a little exception there, but so I'm constructing these biographies and then going through this prosopographical analysis to see if I can create a picture and a portrait. So, you know, I'm being critical of myself, I suppose.
We've got one final, very, very, very quick question and a very quick answer.
So it's a more sexual question, because also I cannot read these lines. But as far as I understood, there are sporting grounds and the races took place there. Mm-hmm. And so they get money by interest tickets.
Yeah.
But in Germany and also in the US, but in many other European countries, maybe here in England as well, there were this runners who made this long distance runs from Berlin to Moscow, Manson Ernst or Fritz Kepernick at Berlin. So they were their own entrepreneurs, and they did not use grounds, but they did run cross country. Mm-hmm. Did this phenomenon appear here as well, or is this?
Yeah, you do see that, but yeah, I suppose towards, you know, the 1840s, 1850s, especially the 1860s, when these grounds were established, they took the long distance into the arenas, and, you know, they would still do, you know, the traditional, you know, foot races over, you know, 6 days, things like that. But it would be done in the race grounds because they could charge, you know, instead of people watching it for free on the roads, you know, and you know, doing whatever they want, they would charge entrance, and, you know, We were discussing this the other day, and there was reports of, you know, in an evening they would, you know, put up lights so that, you know, people could still come in an evening and watch these runners performing these events in the grounds. But it was all about containing and making a profit, and so you see less and less of the walking, especially I suppose with the industrialisation of England. You know, we didn't have the space, the land anymore, so it was all really self-contained within the sporting grounds towards the end.
We should discuss why this was only here. As far as I know, in Germany, I have never heard about it.
They were still running their distances.
And I have not heard about it in any other countries.
I think the debate's going to have to go on a little bit later. Just right on the excess. Thank you very much.